I'm Kathleen Dunn on this first afternoon of spring. I have to pinch myself to remember it's spring. It's actually spring. It's great. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and this hour of the show, the author of really a wonderful book, Dear Abigail, The Intimate Lives and Revolutionary Ideas of Abigail Adams and Her Two Remarkable Sisters. I'm always amazed to read about people who were so important in American history and had to deal with so much adversity in their lives, and that certainly was true of Abigail Adams. Diane Jacobs is our guest, and she has written several other books, one of whom we'll refer to during the course of our conversation because she had a lot to write about education of women, her own woman, the life of Mary Wollstonecraft. She has taught Diane at Dartmouth, the Columbia University School of the Arts, NYU School of Continuing and Professional Studies. She's written for the New York Times and the Village Voice and has spent, it must be something to immerse yourself in this whole period of history for such a long time. For 10 years, she's been researching and writing this book, going through the many letters that the three sisters wrote to each other. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Diane as we talk primarily about Abigail, but the others as well, and John. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hello, Diane.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Yeah. I always think I'd like to be inside your mind for a moment and just your life for the last 10 years to become so involved in this time in history and in these women's letters and lives for such a long period of time in your life. What does that do to you?
Well, you do feel as if you're living in two different centuries.
I imagine.
And part of me was going along with Abigail and her sisters and John and the revolution. I mean, sometimes I could feel, oh, the revolution is happening outside my window. And then, then I'd put them away and I'd go out and live my 21st century life.
And wish that Abigail and her sisters could come right along with you, which would be fun. You write about the sisters being born in an age of inspiration and an age of conflict. We certainly know the incredible conflict. What about the age of inspiration, and how much did they take in this age of inspiration as they were growing up together?
Well, the Enlightenment was so important to their education, and they were not officially educated even by their father. Their father basically said, well, let your mother teach you reading and math, and that's about it. But the eldest sister is Mary Cranch, and when her husband first came into the household, he saw these three sisters, and he thought, wow, they really have all these intellectual ambitions, and they're so curious about everything. So he opened up the books of the Enlightenment to them. So they began reading Locke and Rousseau and Hume, and they were very, very much involved in the Enlightenment. On the other hand, they were also very much under the influence of the Puritan Church, mm-hmm. and those were often conflicting influences on them.
And very much a part of their times, how can you not be, where you also write the most important and usually the only choice a woman made in America in the late 18th century was who she married.
Yes, that's true. And I think it's borne out by the fact that the name of this book is Abigail Adams and Her Two Remarkable Sisters, because it was because Abigail married John Adams mm-hmm. that we know what we do about her. And why I had to sleuth so much to find out about her sisters.
The other thing that was interesting is that it was the girls in the family who really prized education. They had a brother, but he couldn't give two hoots about learning, it would appear to me.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. How did that happen?
There should be three stars,
right?
Really academic stars. You can see if they were living today, they'd all be, you know, going to Harvard and Yale. And then there's this one dud, and he's the one the parents have been longing for. They want to have a boy that will guarantee their posterity. And it turns out to be Billy, who has no interest whatsoever, who says, I don't want to go to Harvard.
Right.
And the three girls are so longing to go. They're so envious of their cousin who goes off to Harvard. But Billy has no interest.
Yeah.
So it's chance.
Yeah, it is chance, isn't it? We know that with our children, it's chance.
Right.
The father and the mother, I want to talk about both their father and mother because obviously those are important influences in our lives. I love this description. I could just see it of these young girls who were really taught to do a whole lot of household chores, and their mother saw to it that they did their fair share. And what they did to make sure that they weren't bitten by animals. What was that story? Was it about a peacock putting some kind of a thing over the peacock so you wouldn't get bitten?
Yes, so you wouldn't get bitten while you were using it.
Right.
They learned all of these tricks that you needed to know in order to make soap, in order to do the laundry and do the cooking. So yes, and that was primarily their job.
Yeah. And their father, you talk about their father who loved philosophy and had an aversion to petty gossip. You can't escape that totally, I'm sure, if you're the girls. But he wanted them to talk about things and not to talk about people.
Yes, and I think that made a big impact on them.
Mm-hmm.
Because even in their letters, it's so interesting because today we'll frequently begin, usually it's an email rather than a letter, but we'll begin with the personal and then we'll kind of slide into what's happening in the world. But they were quite the opposite. They would always begin with something large, some either intellectual concept or some political event. And then at the very end, they'd tack on something personal, almost as if they were embarrassed.
Mm. You mentioned Richard, who went on to marry Abigail's older sister, Mary, as transforming the lives of all three sisters, a very smart man. We don't remember him very much in history, but he, as you just said, was it because of the books, the ideas that he brought to those girls?
Well, he was an amazing character. He was a terrible businessman. Mary had to take in boarders all her life, which was really quite embarrassing for a woman of her standing because he just never could make money in business. On the other hand, everybody was in awe of his mind.
Mm.
And so he came into their lives and he wanted to enlighten them. And he also had a lot of influence within the community, not in the nation the way John Adams did, but he was a judge for his section of Massachusetts, and he was on the state legislature. So he did have a lot of influence. It was just that he had no business sense, and they were constantly poor.
John Adams liked him very much, didn't he?
Yes. It was through Richard that John Adams came into the Smith household, and that's what Abigail's maiden name was, Smith. It was through his friendship with Richard that John was invited to come.
Let's talk about each of the girls. Mary, most like her mother, you write, although, this is a theme that runs through all of them and is something that we so admire in the time in which we're living. Mary, most like her mother, although inwardly, you write, she seethed at the neglect of the mind. They all did,
yes.
Really.
Yes, they really did not feel it was fair that they were not formally educated, and they went on to formally educate their children and to use the same male tutor who was tutoring their boys to tutor their girls. So they did try to rectify what their parents had been falling a little bit short on.
Mm-hmm. And what was the model? Where were they given a model of how young girls should be educated or not be educated? Who was setting the norm in those years?
Well, there was a lot of conflict. The Puritan Church, on the one hand, said you have to raise your intellectual level in order to marry because a man has to marry a woman who he can talk to. So there was that influence. Then there was the influence of the blue stockings. They knew about the blue stockings in England and how they had been educated. They knew later on very much about Mary Wollstonecraft, but that was later in their lives. And they also knew about these rather like how-to books that were saying, hide your knowledge. It's That's the worst thing you can possibly do is show that you're an intelligent woman. No man will ever marry you. So they had all these conflicting views coming in on them.
This view that you write about, that they could not ignore the received wisdom that girls' reproductive systems had a deleterious effect on their minds. Who in the world said that?
It was so terrible because that was something that was believed also totally in Europe as well as in the colonies. It was believed that women were given two organs. They were given other organs too, but the major organs were their mind and their uterus. And if you used your mind, say the way a woman in France who opened a salon did, well, then no wonder she would be unable to bear children.
Uh-huh.
And on the other hand, if you bore children, well, of course you were going to make idiotic small talk because, you know, you could only use one organ. So it was so ridiculous, but at the time it was pretty much accepted. And I became very impressed with Mary, the eldest sister, when I read one letter that she wrote to Abigail saying, aren't men just foolish that they can actually see who women are and at the same time they think that we have gendered minds and that we can't think the way they do or we won't be able to bear children.
Yeah.
And that was really quite a profound and rebellious statement at
mm-hmm.
that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about the bearing of children. The other thing that is so striking to me as I read about Abigail's life and certainly her sister's lives as well is how incredibly difficult, not only for the time, you know, with war about to happen with England, but the cold and the snow and all the sickness and the smallpox and the stillbirths and the pregnancies. Oh, my gosh, what a hard life.
Well, what a hard life. In fact, I have a friend who was reading my book, and she kept calling me every time she came to a new illness. She would say, oh, no, no.
Oh.
So dysentery was enough. Now we have smallpox.
Yeah.
Oh, no, no, you know, can't be scarlet fever. So they did. They endured all of these different plagues.
Mm-hmm.
And they never knew if they would live from one day to the next.
Yeah, and some of their children didn't, or their brothers or their family members didn't make it through.
Right. I mean, there were some real tragedies. I don't want to ruin the suspense in the book, but there were some real tragedies mm-hmm. in the death of children.
So tell me about the importance of the letter writing. You start the book with Abigail writing to Mary and really wanting to get together with her and it being difficult for the reasons that we just mentioned. It was not, even though it was only 25 miles or something, it was a difficult journey for her to make. Did she write to her for intellectual companionship or to say, here, I need your shoulder to cry on because John isn't here again and I got to do all these things by myself and I sure could use some help or somebody to say, that's not good, Abigail?
Well, I think for all the reasons that you mentioned and also for gossip, even though it was at the end of the letter, they always got in the gossip, like, have you heard what this neighbor's doing? And do you know that this one's pregnant and this is when she got married and I'm not so sure that that's enough months? And also when they had little children, they wanted to compare notes on, well, what is your child doing? What is your child wearing? And they had daughters who were very close to each other. So that also became very important to them, the friendship between Abigail's daughter, Navi, and Mary's daughter, Betsy.
And did they treat their younger sister, who was a teenager when they were in their 20s, do you think, as almost as one of their children, or did they consider her to be a full-fledged adult, a woman among equals?
Well, I think Abigail in particular. Abigail, I think, never really got over not being the eldest sister. She realized that she had to really pay respect to her older sister because hierarchy was so important in the Puritan church. And Mary was definitely at the top of the ladder. But she wanted someone to lord it over a little bit, and I think she used Elizabeth, and I think it was particularly Abigail. Mary also would agree with Abigail, but she would be happy to humor Elizabeth. But Abigail wanted to be telling Elizabeth what she should and shouldn't do, and particularly regarding who she decided to marry.
Mm-hmm. And Elizabeth was sickly quite a bit, wasn't she?
Yes, Elizabeth was the frailest. She was also the one who had to take care of her parents because the others left the family home and got married. And she was 6 years younger than Abigail. So she had to take care of her family, and then she would get sick, and she had a hard time. She was also the most beautiful, the liveliest of them. She was the one who wanted to be a writer. So she was a very interesting character. And she also, she was feisty. She could stand up to Abigail. They were equal in the contest.
Well, that's saying something, to stand up to Abigail, because when I think of her, I think of feisty. That's the first adjective that comes to mind, actually.
Well, Elizabeth was definitely, and Abigail saw Elizabeth as feisty, because Elizabeth would just say, I don't care what you say. So Abigail would say, I think you should come to Boston and meet somebody. I don't like this suitor that you're seeing. And she'd say, well, forget it. I'm not going to. I'm perfectly happy here.
So, Diane, who did Elizabeth wind up marrying?
Well, Elizabeth wound up marrying the man that Abigail disliked during the courtship. And, in fact, when she announced that she was marrying this man who was a minister and a Calvinist and would make it imperative that Elizabeth move to New Hampshire, John wrote Abigail at the time and said, oh, please give my respects to Elizabeth and congratulate John Shaw, who was the minister. And Abigail wrote back, I would not mention this. I haven't exchanged a word with Elizabeth on this topic. I am so embarrassed.
Oh.
The only reason she can possibly be marrying this man is because she's almost 30. I mean, she was 27 at the time, and that wasn't such an unusual age to marry during that era. So that's who she married. And I never could get to know John Shaw through his letters the way I got to know Richard Cranch, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
But through Elizabeth's letters, I came to see how he changed as the years went on. And there's a very dramatic scene or series of scenes in the book that involve him.
We'll talk about the revolution and how the sisters responded to the Stamp Act and where their sympathies were early on in the Revolutionary War. We'll talk about, you can't talk about, Abigail obviously has the bare role in this because she was the First Lady of the United States, and what she had to bear was quite remarkable because her husband is off, you know, putting the country together, figuring out what it's going to be, and she is taking care of children and warding off disease and warding off British soldiers and just has this huge task, and he's gone all the time. It's not easy. We'll welcome phone calls. The book is pretty new. I don't know if you have had a chance to read it, but you certainly have a lot to say about one of the sisters, Abigail Adams and John Adams. The book is Dear Abigail, The Intimate Lives and Revolutionary Ideas of Abigail Adams and Her Two Remarkable Sisters. Diane Jacobs is our guest. Here's how you reach our conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're talking with the author of Dear Abigail, The Intimate Lives and Revolutionary Ideas of Abigail Adams and Her Two Remarkable Sisters, with an emphasis, of course, on Abigail because she was the First Lady and because we know more about her because she was the First Lady. So we welcome your phone calls and your thoughts, particularly about her, or some of you may know a great deal about the sisters as well. I want to talk about the outbreak of war and where the sisters' sympathies were and if they disagreed with each other on things like the Stamp Act, et cetera. What a time in which to live. Were they of one mind on whether or not we should be an independent country?
They were. They were, and they came to it reluctantly. They came to their decision reluctantly. I think initially with the Stamp Act, they were against the Stamp Act, but then the Stamp Act was repealed. And at that point, John Adams said, well, okay, I have no interest in politics anymore. That's over, and we're not going to have any problems anymore. So it wasn't as if they were just waiting to have a fight and wanting to disconnect themselves from England. They loved England very much. They identified with England. Mary actually named her first daughter after Queen Elizabeth, the former British queen. And so there was a lot of love for England. But as one horrible act after another was imposed on the colonies, they all shared the idea that this is not right. And then ultimately they came to the conclusion, well, there's nothing to do but to break with England.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Allison calling in from Plum Lake. Hi, Allison.
Hi. I have a quote that my mother gave me when I left for college and I went to study history of art in California. And the quote was a letter that John Adams wrote to his wife, and it starts off, "Dear Portia," and it says, like, "It is our duty to study, like, navigation and military arts and agriculture so that our sons may study, you know, like, architecture and some engineering."
Right.
So their sons will have a right to study art and poetry and music, dance. And it's when I think he was in France, overwhelmed by the beauty of this deep and, you know, many century culture, that he was writing to her about how early America was in the process of refining. And
I think that's the most poetical letter. I think it's such a poetic letter. And I think what he was saying basically, and you going off to art school or to study art, you definitely were of the generations he was looking forward to. I think he was saying, well, today I have to be away from you. I have to be a statesman. I have to create a country where we can then go on and have architects to build buildings, and we can have people who will study literature and study art, and that's all down the line. So it's not just us. So as I'm involved in this, and as I'm separated from you and from my children, we can think of the future generations.
Why did your mom give you that, Allison? Do you know?
Well, yeah, she was a math major at Wellesley.
Oh.
And had her father died before she got married or anything, so she moved back from the East Coast and kind of started a different life than she would have had she stayed on the East Coast and had her career.
Mm-hmm.
But it was definitely that I think she sacrificed a lot for me. And
oh,
she was sort of saying,
that's moving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so she used to say, be all you can be, see all you can see, and listen once in a while.
That's good advice.
I think it's a beautiful letter to give to a child,
mm-hmm.
because this is your entitlement, or you feel it's your entitlement, because so many people have suffered beforehand.
Right. Thank you, Allison.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. She mentioned that letter and John being gone in France for a long period of time. I found it interesting that Abigail is carrying on this letter flirtation during that time period. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yes. I mean, I wouldn't have during the era. It would have been quite,
right.
quite taboo. But I think here she was. She was in her mid-30s. She was an attractive woman. She'd always been a very attractive woman. And unlike the women that John was cavorting about with, not sexually, but socializing with in Paris, she was not allowed to go anywhere but to church. To church and her neighbors and her sisters, because otherwise she would be accused of flirting. So she found a way to flirt, and that was through letters to
the congressman who actually was doing a lot of the work that John had done before he went to Europe, James Lovell, and he was more than willing to flirt back.
And how long did this go on?
Well, it went on really until Abigail went to join John, which, so I would say maybe 4 years.
Oh, my goodness.
They never saw each other during that time. They had met once long before, or they thought they had met. They weren't sure. But it was all epistolary. But it gave Abigail the opportunity to be a woman, which she was very much missing, being still in her 30s and having this husband who was far away and rarely wrote.
Right.
He was always too busy. He kept saying, oh, you want me to write you all these details? Here I have such important business. I'm dealing with the future of our nation. And she was like, well, fine, but
right.
I want someone to pay a little attention to me.
Right, which is understandable. So did she was alone for such long stretches of time and really taking care of family and everything, safety
everything.
And health. Did she write in her letters to her sisters that you have recovered complaining about this? Did she have anybody to say, hey, he's just not around. I have too much to do.
Well, she complained to Lovell, who was the man she was flirting with. And she would say, oh, my husband's so wonderful, but I haven't heard from him. And I'm sure in person she complained a lot to Mary. She was actually living at that point very near Mary and Richard. So there were not letters between them during that time when John was away. But she made it known. She made it known that she wasn't happy, and she certainly made it known to John. John was the primary one who she complained to. And no matter how many times he would say, I have important business, she would say, well, I'm important business too.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel as if I'm deserted and I'm a widow and I'm very unhappy.
Mm-hmm. And what were they, at what point was it when she went to France that she and John sort of started this book club between them? They were doing some reading of the same philosophers?
Oh, they always read the same philosophers. They did that when they were together. They did that when he was in Philadelphia. Whatever, I mean, sometimes he would hear of a book from her. And there was, like, when Common Sense came out, Thomas Paine's Common Sense, they both leapt on that book at just about the same moment. And he was certainly someone who wanted to be dealing with an intelligent and educated woman. So after Richard Cranch went on, it was John Adams who was really her tutor.
Mm-hmm. And let's catch up on the two sisters and what happened during the course of their lives, her sister Mary and her sister Elizabeth. The marriages, those as well, weren't exactly made in heaven.
Well, I feel like Mary really married the man she wanted to marry.
Mm-hmm.
That she was always deeply in love with Richard and he with her. They were a unit. That she would have loved it if he had made a little more money or he'd been able to figure out some kind of business scheme that didn't totally fail. But she adored his mind and she adored him. So I feel like that was basically a happy marriage, even though she did have to take in boarders and whatever. And she also she had great administrative ability, so she became sort of a de facto mayor of the town that both she and Abigail lived in.
Yeah.
And so when the populace would elect Richard Cranch to an office, for instance, to choose a new minister, they would also know that the one who would really be handling it would be Mary. So she had a lot of authority, and she had a lot of authority in the family, of course. And then Elizabeth did not have, her first marriage was not made in heaven, but she had her literary aspirations. She was the best educated of all of the sisters because she was the youngest when Richard came into the household.
Mm-hmm.
So she had the most time to study with him. And she always wanted to publish a book of letters. And I'm hoping that someday someone will publish a book of her letters, because she really worked at it. It was a performance for her to write a letter.
Oh, that's interesting. Why don't you do that?
Well, I may. It's tempting.
Yeah.
Some of her letters are precious, but on the other hand, they're grammatically perfect, and they're so filled with emotions and feeling and poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone revered her. All the children in the family, she was the one that they would run to. They would say maybe Abigail was a little bit too strict, maybe Mary was very strict, but then there was Elizabeth, who was so loving and emotional and could identify with every single sensation they had.
What did they think, the sisters, when John and thus Elizabeth rose to such prominence in this country? I mean, he was such a major figure in the formation of America.
Yes, and they knew him from the time when he was a lowly lawyer, but they had seen him slowly rise. So I think that by the time he went to France, they were prepared that he was going to be the statesman that they knew the best, who would have the most impact on the future of the government. So I don't think that was that big a surprise. I think what was a surprise to them was once he came back from Europe and he was made vice president of the United States under Washington, and they realized Abigail was going to be moving. It wasn't just that she went to England and France, but now she was going to be moving, as she did. She moved to New York when she was the wife of the vice president, and to Philadelphia. Then she was in Philadelphia again as the wife of the second president of the United States, and ultimately in the White House, the first resident of the White House.
And did they were they very, very glad for her?
Oh, they were very mixed, as she was mixed for herself. In the end, when John lost the 1800 election to Jefferson, Abigail said, "Well, it's too bad, you know, he doesn't have this term, but thank God I can come home." And she was really happy to come home.
Yeah,
all the traveling did uh-huh. wear on her. It was exciting. She got to meet people she never would have met otherwise, and she took advantage of that. But her longing always was to come home.
Yeah. And when John came, he didn't initially come a courting, but let's go back to when they were young and they all said what they thought about each other's potential husbands or their beaus. What did her sisters say about John Adams?
Well, when the sisters first met John, there was a mutual aversion, especially with Elizabeth was too young, but Mary and Abigail thought he was a very brash and not at all sympathetic lawyer, and a lawyer was not something that their parents would approve of in that era. And then he came into the house, and he thought they were just the most conceited people he'd ever met. And he had awful things to say about their family, their grandfather, who was the most important person in the area, was just useless and arrogant. And anyhow, he had nothing good to say about any of them. And then he came with Richard Cranch to just sit and socialize one night, and he fell madly in love with Abigail, who he called Miss Adorable. And at that point, everything changed. He loved the family. The father was great, and the grandfather was so wise, nothing could be better. The family did not feel that way so quickly about him. Abigail, quite quickly, was seduced by his intellect, his wit, his humor, but not her parents. They felt like, well, your first opinion of this man was right. And it took them quite a long time to come around. They did come around. They came to adore him.
Mm-hmm. We welcome phone calls if you'd like to join the conversation. I know the book is out recently, so perhaps you haven't had a chance to read it. But let me also entertain a couple of possibilities of ways for you to join the conversation. The book, of course, centers a great deal on Abigail Adams. It's Dear Abigail, The Intimate Lives and Revolutionary Ideas of Abigail Adams and Her Two Remarkable Sisters. Remarkable because they were allowed during their lifetimes to, well, they had to fit a certain kind of role that women had to fit in order to be acceptable, presentable during the 18th century. But they were also real whippersnappers. They were smart as could be, and they were educated by Mary, her older sister's boyfriend and subsequent husband, who brought a great deal of philosophy and literature into the house and was responsible in helping to educate all three of the sisters. But then this deep thought about the role of education and remembering the ladies and feeling upset that they weren't able to, they could educate their sons, but they had to or were supposed to educate their daughters somewhat differently, which of course they did not do. But feel free to join our conversation. And did I tell you how to do that? Well, here is how you do it. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Diane Jacobs is our guest. Diane is the author of a number of other books, including, pertinent to our conversation, Her Own Woman, The Life of Mary Wollstonecraft. She has taught at Dartmouth and the Columbia University School of the Arts, NYU School of Continuing and Professional Studies. She's contributed to the New York Times and the Village Voice and has written this wonderful book about the three sisters. And she spent the last 10 years of her life, a good portion of it, researching and writing the book. We'll talk about that process as we continue. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dear Abigail, The Intimate Lives and Revolutionary Ideas of Abigail Adams and Her Two Remarkable Sisters is what we are talking about this hour of the program, and welcoming your calls. Perhaps it's just, well, it is just fine for you to listen, but don't feel as though you can't participate. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Can we talk a little bit, Diane, about the war? We do want to talk about the war that was going on during their lives as well, and what the sisters had to do to keep their families safe. This was a really treacherous time.
It was such a treacherous time, and they were in Boston, which was just about the most dangerous place you could be at the beginning of the war. And they saw the Battle of Bunker Hill, or Abigail in particular, went to the top of Penn's Hill, which is where she lived, and she looked down and she could see all of Charleston burning. So it was just very dramatic. It was a time that they both followed, partly through John, who was trying to make a new government, and partly through the headlines, as we do. There was no television or radio, of course, but they'd follow what battle had just happened, and they were very involved, even if it was Yorkville. I mean, of course, if it was Boston, they would then it was something that could really encroach upon their lives and their safety. But even when it was Yorktown, they just followed it, and they followed the troops going south to Yorktown, and they got reports from people along the way. Lovell, for instance, the man who Abigail was flirting with, would report, oh, this is what happened when they got to Philadelphia. This is what the troops did here and there. So they were extremely involved in this whole idea of creating the ideal nation.
And what about their lives, Diane? Were their lives endangered?
Well, Mary was in Boston when the Lexington and Concord took place, when the first shot was fired. So, but there wasn't really any kind of action. She was just trapped in Boston because the British now owned it. They were never really in physical danger. They were in much more danger from disease and from childbirth than they were from the action.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about childbirth for a while. There is a very moving scene where Abigail is in her 30s and she has a stillbirth. And I partially it's your writing and her description of this, but it was just such a, must have been such a difficult thing to have that many children. You know, in those days, just unbelievable.
It was. And at the same time, she so wanted another daughter.
Right.
It's interesting because there's so many cultures that really prefer sons. But the colonial culture, especially New England, they wanted daughters because daughters were the ones who would take care of them. Who knew what the sons would do? They'd go off somewhere, but the daughters would stick around and take care of them. So, yes, and the death of a child, which has often been sort of made to seem like not such a terrible thing by people writing about the earlier centuries, was really, I found from my research, just so dreadful.
Mm-hmm.
It's so depressed, both of the parents, and I was very moved by how John was so moved by the death. And he said something to the effect of, "It's amazing that I can care so much about something that I never saw, but that somehow it feels part of me."
And they had lost another daughter.
Yes. And Abigail actually said, well, the stillbirth was awful, but it wasn't as bad as losing their daughter who was a year old when they were living in Boston before the revolution. And that was such a terrible occurrence that Abigail did not mention it between the time it happened, which must have been something like 1775, and the late 1780s, when she was sending Nabby off to America. Nabby had just gotten married, that's her daughter, and she was writing to the mother-in-law, and she said, please don't blame Nabby if she's not as social as you might like, but she never had a sister.
Mm.
And at that point, she says, you know, that this child that she had hoped would socialize, Nabby, died when she was a year old.
Mm. And what about their parents, the girls' parents? Who did take care of them? How long a life did each of them live?
Well, the mother died quite young. Elizabeth was still at home. You mean the parents of,
yes,
of Abigail, Mary, and Elizabeth?
Yes.
Yes. The mother died quite young. She died from a dysentery that she caught taking care of Abigail.
Mm-hmm.
So Abigail always felt a bit guilty about that. And their father lived until right before Abigail left for France. And Abigail had promised her father that she wouldn't leave America while he was alive. So they all took care of the father, and Abigail and Mary were the ones who lived closest to him. And Abigail really felt she could not leave while he was alive.
Mm-hmm.
And then he died, and she agreed to go and meet John in Europe.
So tell me about the letters themselves, Diane. Were there all kinds of letters? Did they write to each other once a week? And yeah, even getting a letter in those days must have been a difficult thing.
Well, at a certain point during the Revolution, the letters were intercepted very regularly, so they had to be very careful about what they wrote. But they wrote very regularly. Elizabeth was, as you had mentioned before, she was always feeling a little bit left out, and she would write them, and they wouldn't write back so quickly. But Abigail was so dependent upon Mary and hearing from Mary that if she didn't hear from her once a week, she would be reprimanding her. And Mary, who was home trying to get a minister for the church or whatever, would say, "Oh, Abigail, you have to understand, I have things to do." And Abigail would say, "Yes, but you have to get in touch with me at least once a week." And she wasn't the only one who valued Mary's letters. One day she came in, I think they were living in Philadelphia, and Adams was the president at that point, and she saw her husband just
creeping around with this letter that he was trying to hide. And she said, what are you up to? And it was a letter from Mary, and she got very angry. She said, you can't read my private mail. And he said, well, but it's just so great. I never learn as much as I do from a letter from Mary. So these letters were really prized. Also, they read each other's letters aloud. For instance, when Abigail was in Europe and she was going to balls at St. James, or she was going out to visit Madame Lafayette, she would write these letters back to Mary that Mary would then sit around, and she'd invite all her neighbors over, and they would rush over, and she would be, there would be little parts where Abigail would say, now this is just for you, but the other parts she would read aloud, and Mary actually wrote Abigail at one point, you have made me the most popular person in the area. Because when they hear there's a letter from you, everyone is clamoring to come in and hear it.
Yeah. So where did you find all the letters? And are there many of them preserved?
Yes. And, well, the Massachusetts Historical Society is the main place. And luckily, they have microfilms that are all over the country. So you can find them in almost every state. And I did initially work from the microfilm that was in New York. And then later on, they put it on a DVD for me, and I was able to read it much more easily. But that was Abigail. Also, there's a lot of Mary, and there's quite a bit of Elizabeth. But where I really had to go for the other two sisters was, well, for Elizabeth, I had to go to the Library of Congress. And there, what I really loved was there was this trove of correspondence between her and her cousin Isaac that she wrote when she was a teenager. And he was off at Harvard, and he would suggest books to her, and she'd read the books, and she would always have a reaction, and it would always be contrary to whatever Isaac had said. So she wasn't taking his word for anything. She'd say, well, you may say that, but I think this. So she was definitely feisty in her reactions. And also, she was kind of in love with Isaac at the time. So he wrote her at one point, and I think he was really teasing her, oh, I think you would really love Madame de Sévigné's letters, because Madame de Sévigné thought romance was a dull emotion, and she didn't care about marriage. She thought you could take it or leave it. And this got Elizabeth particularly irate, because she didn't want Isaac to think that, because she didn't know. Maybe she wanted to marry Isaac.
Right.
So she wrote back and said, oh, no, I can't stand Madame de Sévigné's views. Her letters are beautiful, but her views are awful.
It must have made you long for the days when we wrote each other letters.
Oh, it does. It does, because the letters were just so captivating. I mean, 10 years is a long time, and of course, some of that time I was writing and not researching, although I researched really right up to the end. But I loved being immersed in these letters. I loved their reactions to what happened day to day. I love just seeing these, and I love seeing their thoughts on everything, which they shared in letters. I don't know what we'll do in the future.
I know. And what a way to learn history, too, that you have a different view, a more intimate view of the historical, of those times, which are so worth knowing about, and what a nice way to learn more about it.
Well, that's really what I aimed for. I really wanted, at the same time that I was creating these characters who I love, and I hope everyone loves my girls. I always say to friends, do you like my girls? But I also wanted to be interwoven with the times and with the ideas. And that was something that was very important to me, was to be able to convey what the ideas that these three women had, and especially what they had to say about the ideal nation.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us. The book is just delightful, and I thoroughly enjoyed listening to you and conversing with you this hour. Thanks, Diane.
Thanks so much for having me.
Diane Jacobs, the book is Dear Abigail, The Intimate Lives and Revolutionary Ideas of Abigail Adams and Her Two Remarkable Sisters. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour, and thanks to K.P. Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And thanks for listening, everybody. I'll be with you again on Monday. We'll have All Things Political, which is our regular feature Mondays at 1 o'clock, and lots of interesting shows next week. So I hope you'll be with us, plus interesting conversations ahead. Stay tuned for Central Time momentarily, right after news from NPR, which you will be hearing just very momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.